The following tape is that of Bess Chamberlain, a pioneer Alaskan who came to Alaska in 1914. This tape is being made at the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce log cabin by the Tano Yukon Historical Society. The tape is recorded on September 26th, 1968. The moderator is Charles Mays.
Well, Mrs. Chamberlain, would you care to begin this interview by telling us who you are?
Yes, I am Bess Chamberlain.
And you're a long-time Alaskan?
Yes, I've been here for 53 years.
Well, that's quite a long stretch. Can you tell us what caused you to first come into the North Country?
Yes, my husband had trading posts up above Nome all the way to Kobuk and Kiana and Selwick and Noatak, Kotzebue.
And could you?
Deering and Candle, Alaska.
Did he have a particular name for this string of trading posts that he had?
Just his last name, Magus Brothers.
And from where did he come to begin with?
Well, he came from Russia originally, but he came to Nome in 1902. And used to dog team from Nome to Deering and Kotzebue and up the rivers with trading materials.
And I presume that he carried the mail at the same time?
No, he was an independent trader.
And his clientele was mostly Eskimo, I presume?
Yes, Eskimos, very few white people.
And the Eskimo were, though, at that time pretty much living off the country. They were still the hunting Eskimo.
Oh, yes, they were. That was their...
Living in skin tents?
Yes.
And living off the caribou largely?
And yes, they were reindeer and caribou.
But by this time, the reindeer industry had begun to take form.
Oh, yes.
And do you remember any of these... Eskimo people, the names of them with whom you might have had contact, some of them that stand out in your mind more or less for some reason or other?
Well, there was the chiefs up at Kayata. That was my first home. And there were two chiefs there. Oh, there were about 100 Eskimos there, families, a man and wife and children. And then there were about 20 white men that were mining up the creek. And the chief's name was Ituyurik. And Ataturik. And there were several families there I just can't recall their names. It's over 50 years ago.
Well, now, you mentioned your first home there. Now, what sort of a home was it? Was it a log?
No, it was a frame building, though there was a little log cabin alongside of it. And it was this two-story building. Our store was downstairs, and we had living quarters upstairs, very crudely fixed up. They were half partitioned, and the very little furniture in it. But I had brought along my silverware and my linens, and we lived just like you would in the States, even to having a bathtub. That was one of the things I insisted upon when my husband said, "What did you want to take up north?" And I said, "I wanted a bathtub." Of course, we had to bring water up from the river and heat the water on in a tin tub on the stove in order to get hot water, but we managed very nicely.
Well, you had running water, but you just had to run down and get it.
Yes, run down and get it. Run up the hill with it, too, in 5-gallon buckets.
I presume that the Eskimos' primary need was for guns, ammunition, traps, things of that nature?
Oh, yes, but they had gotten accustomed to the white ways. They wanted flour and sugar.
Coffee
and tea and, even butter.
Mm-hmm.
And lard. But, and they bought clothing. They also made fur clothes for themselves, which was one of the essentials up there because it would get to be 60, 70 below zero on the river. We only stayed there 2 years. Then we came down to Kotzebue, where we already had a trading post, but we had a man in charge there. And
could you tell us who was in charge of your post at Kotzebue?
Yes, there was a man by the name of Paul Davidovitz. He raised a big family there, about 18 or 20 children.
And I presume he was a white man?
Yes, he was a white man. I think we called him a gypsy because he was a good trader. And he had four or five wives.
Now, were you the only white woman in your area?
In Cayenne, I was the only white woman there.
And were there very many in Kotzebue at that time?
Oh, yes. There was about 100 Eskimos.
White women?
White women. There were two missionaries and a government teacher, BIA.
And you say that there were only about 100 people all told at Kotzebue at that time?
At that time, yes.
Now, what year was that now?
That was 1915.
Mm-hmm.
And 16. The natives would come down in the spring of the year where they'd hold a potlatch at Kotzebue, and they'd come over from Siberia, and there'd be a great deal of trading between the Siberian Eskimos and our coast Eskimos. They'd come all the way from Point Hope and Point Barrow, and they'd hold their potlatch there. They had a great big tent, oh, as large as this room. And they used to have their dances there and hold their powwows. And I've seen a copper kettle change hands 20 times in one day.
Well, why would it change hands? Were they gambling for it?
Well, no, they were bidding for it with furs. And they'd have mink and fox and land otter. And they all wanted to possess that copper kettle, you know. That was this distinction. If you owned a copper kettle, you were just thought to be the elite.
Well, I presume it was a large
kettle. Yes, it was. Large enough to feed 25, 30 people.
Well, I don't believe that white whalers came into Kotzebue very much, did they?
No. Captain Backlund was our only white trader that came from any distance. He came from Seattle, and he had a sailing boat.
You mean that used sails for propulsion?
Pardon?
Used sails.
Yes.
Did it have an engine, too?
No, it was just on sails.
Well, you have a very severe winter there at Kotzebue, as I understand.
Oh, yes, it is. It gets very cold there, and it's a long winter, too, between 8 and 9 months. Navigation closes up there about the 1st of October and doesn't open up again until, the first part of July.
Well, from Kotzebue, where did you people go?
We went to Cayenne and to Deering, and then up the rivers and to Candle, which was a mining community. There were more white people there. And Deering, too, was a white community where they did mining.
Well, that was gold mining.
Yes.
And platinum mining came in later?
Well, just in one or two spots. There was very little platinum in our part of the country. It was all gold.
Did you hear anything about jade up in that area when you were there?
Oh, yes.
The Eskimos were using jade for ornaments and things?
Well, yes, and we excavated two or three times for cellars and found jade ornaments there. Oh, such things as combs, back combs, you know, for the woman's hair, and all sorts of, well, I guess they cut with it too, you know. They cut skins with it.
Use it for knives. And
yes.
Well, and apparently then it was quite old. These artifacts that you speak of were quite old, did you say?
Oh, yes. Yes, they were definitely of a 100 years or so. So it proved that they used to go up the rivers and to this Jade Mountain, which I have been to dozens and dozens of times on my way up and down the Kopuk.
Well, you people were in the trading business for a good many years?
Well, my husband since 1902.
And then for how long afterwards?
Well, he passed away in the early 20s, 1920s.
Mm-hmm. And where did he pass away?
In Miami Beach, Florida. Oh.
Well, he got out of the north, frozen north, though.
Yes, uh-huh.
Well, had he been in the north before you met him?
No. No, that was my first trip up north. My brother, though, came to Nome in 1898. And they located on a creek called Bluff on the coast there.
Now, that's a little south of Nome, isn't it?
Yes.
Bluff City, near Bluff City?
Yeah, Bluff proper. Mm.
And they were mining there, I presume.
Oh, yes, they were mining. My brother and his partner, Joe Sullivan, took out, I don't know how many thousands of dollars. And when my brother sold out, he and his partner realized $900,000 from their mining experiments.
Was the mining at Bluff, was it on the beach? Or?
Yes, on the beach. Mm-hmm.
And I presume that your brothers...
Yeah, I have three brothers up there.
They came over to Chilkoot and down the Yukon. Did they go in that way?
Yes, they did. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, Mrs. Chamberlain, I think that you have some prepared notes that you might care to talk on, so... If you don't mind, why, you just proceed. Tell us whatever you want to tell us in your own way.
Well, I first met my husband at the Arctic Club in Seattle. My brother introduced us, and by the way, my brother has given the Arctic Club two silver cups that his dog teams won in Nome. In fact, one of the cups had $20,000 in it when it was presented to my brother. But he was in the States, and when he got back to Nome, there was very little of the $20,000 left. But it didn't bother him at the time because he had plenty of money. I'll tell you, folks, about coming to Alaska. We were married in Seattle, and we went from Seattle to Chicago and New York, where we intended to go to London, where my husband had shipped a number of furs, about 10,000 muskrat, and 500 to 1,000 foxes. And the war broke out that year. It was 1914 and 15. And we came back by way of San Francisco and went to the World's Fair there. And from San Francisco, we came back to Seattle, where we boarded the SS Jefferson and came up to Skagway. Came through Juneau and visited there for a couple days, and then went on to Skagway, where we took a stern wheeler, and we went up the Yukon, or is it down the Yukon, to St. Michael's?
Down.
And there was quite a number of us. There was Mr. and Mrs. Walter Johnson. He was dredging up around the Nome country. Ira Orton, an attorney, and then the Mr. and Mrs. Nestor. And we had aboard Mr. and Mrs. Manley, and they had a cow aboard, taking it to Manley Hot Springs. And we used to have a pitcher of fresh milk every day. And we got down to St. Michael's, and there we found Captain O'Brien with a good ship, Victoria, which I guess all you folks have heard about. And he took us over to Nome. We rode the caisson into where the water was shallow enough, and a barge came up and picked us up and took us into Nome. We were there for a solid month waiting for the ice to go out of Bering Straits, and then we boarded a little boat, about a 70-footer, and it had an engine in it. And there were 20 men aboard, and there was one other white woman. She and her husband were mining up at Deering. His name was Hank Freeze. And, I was awfully seasick. When we got into smooth water, we were at Teller. And I came out on deck for the first time in 5 days and was sitting there and kind of looking out. And towns kept getting smaller and smaller, you know. And I, of course, was a city girl. I didn't know anything about roughing it or having... We had an electric stove in our apartment in Seattle, and I was accustomed to driving around with a chauffeur. We had a car, and this was all new and foreign to me. I had never done any cooking, and he came up to me, Hank Freeze did, and he was a very slow speaker. He said, now, he says, I've just whittled out a lucky stick for you. And he says, you had a good home and you left it, now you can have this. So I accepted it, and we continued on to Deering, where we went from there to Cannell, where we had another post, and then we got to Kotzebue, and it was the 4th of July, and the mosquitoes were just awful. They were just thick, and we had a smudge in the store to keep away from the mosquitoes. And we had two rooms back of the store. One was a bedroom, and the other was a kitchen and dining room, and this little bedroom. Well, the first thing, I wanted to go and see the native dancers, so we got busy and went over to see them, and I was sitting on the ground, watching intently, you know. They were very fascinating, much more so than they are today. And I got home, I was lousy. There was nothing for the Eskimos, you know, to be full of them. And, my brother-in-law, who thought he had a real sense of humor, advised me to use kerosene, and that helped breed them instead of destroying them. Then he said, you know, you're a white woman, you should teach these Eskimos how to bake bread. I didn't know anything about baking bread. He says, I'll show you. So he got me the material, and I started in, and he kept me at it for about 10 hours making that bread. I kept beating it and beating it, and finally I made loaves out of it. And we had a little Lang stove. And I'd forget to put wood in the stove. So my fire would go out, and then I'd have to... Oh, I learned how to build a fire, too, and I made pretty good bread. I soon learned how to make all kinds of bread, because that was the only way we could have anything to eat. And we had nothing but fish to eat for almost 2 months. It was in the spring of the year, you know, and all we could get was... game, you know, and that was hard to get hold of too. But we ate fish, and I learned to prepare it a dozen different ways, which we had all of our traders there at that time, and they had all come down the river, you know, behind the ice, and I tried my best to feed them. I got along pretty good because I was young and eager to learn and willing to do all I could. I never will forget the week or so after I was there, I was invited to have tea with the missionaries and one school teacher there. And one of the women spoke up and said, do you know your husband has a little girl up on the Noatak? So I came home and I said to my husband, now if you have a child in the Noatak, let's bring it here and adopt it. No, he says, I was never that promiscuous around home. I'm not saying what I would do away from home. And you know, they jobbed him. They had an old lady come in from Point Hope, and she walked over to my husband, and I was sitting there in the store. She says, you know, you owe me some calico. And of course I was insinuating that he had been friendly with her. And he says, well, if I owe you something, I'll pay you. And he gave her some calico. But he told me, he says, no, I never have. He says, I never bothered with him, which I took with a grain of salt. Because, you know, men living up north that way, they year in and year out, you never can tell. So I had no trouble, though, after that. And it wasn't any trouble at all to begin with. I took it not too seriously. Well, we went up the Kobuk, and we had two barges in tow of a tugboat. And we slept out on one of the barges and put up a little tent. And we slept on flowers and sugar and things like that. We fared fairly well. And when we got to Kiana, why, that was my home there. And I really enjoyed Kiana. Our house wasn't as comfortable as I should have liked to have had it, but we lived there and we were happy. And just as soon as it froze up, the river froze up, my husband gave me three dogs. He says, you'll have to learn how to handle dogs, he says, because I'll take you on trips with me. So I started in with these three dogs, and there was a little fishing camp about 5 miles from town. I'd go down with the dogs, and sometimes they come home without me, and sometimes I come home without the dogs, but I made it. And then I was promoted to five dogs. And by April, I had seven. And my husband and I decided he had to go to the States. So we hooked up our dogs and we went from Kiana to the head of the Kobuk. And from there across the portage, I think I was the first white woman to cross that portage into Far River. And my husband bought furs on the way down there and up the Kobuk. And we stopped at the first igloo I'd ever been into. It was on the head of the Kobuk River, right at the foot of this portage. We had a native by the name of Stoney Jim. He was with Captain Stoney when they blazed a trail across that portage which was 80 miles. And it took us 10 days to cross the portage. We had a snowshoe all the way, and if we got off of our snowshoes, why, we'd sink down. You'd just have your arms and head above the snow.
I wonder where that would be on the chart. Now, this is Cayenne right here.
Yes, it's up above there.
This is Kobuk over here.
Yes, it's...
And so your portage was over in this general area.
Yes, it was. Paw River. See Paw River there?
I see the Reed River at Blackman.
Yeah, Allakaket.
Allakaket.
That was the first village we stopped at. Well, this Eskimo, when he... the second day we're out on the portage, he took his gun and went out to get rabbits and ptarmigan. He came back and somewhere or another, the barrel on his gun had twisted a little bit and he couldn't get anything. And he said, I'm not going any farther. He says, I'm going home. He says, you know, all the time, two men to one sled. Now, he says, we have a white woman. And that was just too much for him. So my husband kind of teased him and ridiculed him and said, well, when we get back, we'll tell the Eskimos that you refuse to come along with us. So he went out the next day and he came back and he had a big smile on his face. He had discovered what was the matter with his gun and he brought in a great big load of rabbits. There were just millions of rabbits, but they were all dead. They had some sort of a disease that... Of course, it took me a little while to realize that this snow had seceded, you know, and there were rabbits, just like rabbit trees. They were just all through the trees. And I foolishly asked my husband, what were the rabbits doing up in the trees, Dad? And, well, he says, don't you realize that the snow's gone down and that's why the rabbits are there? Well, we were about a half a mile apart. We all had our own grub boxes and our sleeping bags, so that if one would get away from the other, you know, or get lost, we'd have enough to subsist on until Eskimo, my husband, would locate us. And I never will forget one morning we started out, and it was on the other side of the, almost the end of the portage, we saw Mount McKinley. And I just stopped there and, oh, it was beautiful. The sun was coming over the Mount McKinley, which was 100 miles away, if it was, oh, more than that, several hundred miles away. And I was just gazing in rapture, you know, it was just perfectly beautiful. It looked like a strawberry ice cream cone had fallen on top of the mountain. And I must have been there longer than my husband figured I should be, and he started back. And he says, never do that again. You had us terribly worried. Well, the only thing I could think of was a poem I had read once. As I gazed at this beautiful mountain with the sun coming over the top of it, that the sun shone and God smiled. That's the way it affected me. Well, we got to Allakaket, and there was a sign there for strangers, and then the Episcopalian mission was there. And Miss Pomfrey was in charge of it. And we had known Archdeacon Stuck and Bishop Rowe. They had visited at our home in Cayenne and in Kotzebue. And she wanted us to stay over Sunday. Well, in the meanwhile, a white man from Kobuk, or Shungnak as they call it, came along and he had a trader on his sled that he was taking to Fairbanks. And his name was Harry Brown. And Harry said, we asked him why he hadn't come along with us. We had been in his home on the Kobuk, and he said, well, he says, you know, you folks were very nice. He says, you left kindling and cut wood everywhere. He said, excepting the last place, you didn't leave any kindling. But he said, it was good traveling behind you folks because we didn't have any time, necessity of cutting any wood or anything for ourselves. Well, we were going to leave. It was a Friday he came in. We met Miss Pomfrey Saturday, and she wanted us to stay for Sunday services. Well, we were all for going along, you know, but he insisted, so we stayed. And Miss Pomfrey took us to church, and we attended the services there. Then we went to her home, and she had a nice moose roast, and we had this lovely roast, and oh, her food was delicious. Besides that, she produced a bottle of brandy. And she says, this belongs to Archdeacon Stark. And she says, I'm going to give you folks a little drink of it, which she did. And this Harry Brown couldn't keep his eyes off of her. He was enjoying himself immensely. But we had to go on Monday, so we left him there and continued on. We got to Tananaw, well, which is called Tananaw now, but it was Old Fort Gibbon. And we were in the hotel there. Sandy Smith, who used to live up on the Koyukuk, he had joined us on the Yukon. And when we got to Fort Gibbon, we went into the hotel there. I was tired, and I went upstairs to our room, and the bar was right below my sleeping room, and I heard the men, it was a captain, and several of his other men were in there having a drink, I guess, and this captain said, wait until that, my husband was prematurely gray, and he says, wait until that white-haired traitor gets down to civilization, they'll have him arrested for having a young squaw with him. My hair was very black, and it was long. I had two braids down my back, and we had quite a laugh about that. But we went on, and there was a place called Taft. I don't know whether you folks know where it was or not. It was below Tananaw. It was a new mining place, and they had shafts right in town where they go down and gamble. And the town was wide open. I went in for breakfast into the dining room, and the women were a little bit rough and used kind of vile language. And the men shut them up and said, now, you better change your tune, because we have a little white lady here and we don't want. But we stayed in Taft for about 24 hours, and I never got out of my room because it was so rough, you know. We finally got to Fairbanks here, and I'm getting ahead of my story. I met Mrs. Collins at Minto, and we've been friends ever since that time. But we got into Fairbanks, and it was in the spring of the year, and the streets were all full of mud, and it was awful trying to drive our dog team through that. It was a mud hole, Fairbanks was then. It isn't half as nice as it is now. And We put our furs, you know, that my husband had traded for, in sacks and sent them out by mail. And we went from Fairbanks to Cordova, but we stopped at Chitna and got on the train there. There was a train running from Chitna to Cordova, and we put our dogs on the train and came into Cordova, and there we had quite a number of friends that we knew, and amongst them was Dr. Council. And we got aboard the Northwestern and went up and watched them put the first bike in for the railroad. We stayed in Seward for about a week visiting there, and There was a chap by the name of Charlie Kennedy. He was an old miner from up our way up at Candle, and he was sitting there with the head of the Northwest Railroad, and we were all sitting at the same table, and just about when I'd get it within earshot, I'd hear, "Isn't it too bad? Her face will never look the same." I had been snowblind on the trail coming over, and burned to a crisp, you know. The sun is terrific on the snow. And they had me worried. But then we came back to Cordova, and we picked up Dr. Council, and he asked my husband if he wouldn't put away a package with a purser. And my husband said, "Is it valuable?" "Well," Doc Council says, "I think it is." We couldn't understand why he wanted my husband to put it away for him. But we found out when we got to Seattle, we were at the Washington Hotel, and so was Dr. Council. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and he came to our door, and he says, "Can I have my package?" And my husband said, "You've trusted me with it so far. Why can't you wait until morning?" "Well," he says, "I want it right now. I want to show it to somebody." So we asked him what it was, and he had a sea lion. And he had my husband carry it for him all the way to Seattle. He was scared that they were going to search his belongings and find it, you know, and there was a terrific find with it. He brought it to New York where we were, and his father and mother lived in somewhere down south where they had quail. And he brought us a camp full of quail. He wouldn't break the law, really, for any consideration, but he did hunt promiscuously, I might say. And he brought this can of beautiful quail, which he cooked for us at the hotel. And he sold that that sea otter, and he got, about $2,000 for it. Of course, he had to show us New York then. Nothing would do, but he'd show us. He was a nice, charming gentleman and a very good doctor. And so we saw everything that was worthwhile seeing in New York. And then I came back to Seattle and caught the boat back that spring, the Victoria. Well, we would go out every fall and come back in the spring. And we'd leave our traders up north there to take care of the stores. And they were all honest, I will say that. We never had any trouble with any of them. But my husband went to Russia, and he was gone for several months. Then I was coming up on the Victoria, and there was a gray-haired gentleman on the deck there, on the deck. And he, later I went down for dinner, and there was Roald Amundsen. And he was very nice to me. Mrs. Zeppelin and her little daughter were aboard. And we had a stateroom together. There was she and her daughter and myself in a little tiny stateroom. It wasn't any larger than 8x8. And I was up in the upper bunk, and oh, it was horrible weather. And Captain Amundsen had the only stateroom that had a bathroom. Well, Japhet Lindbergh and his wife were aboard. Japhet Lindbergh was one of the first people to come over from Lapland with the reindeer. And Captain Amundsen came in and said, "You can't stay here. I wrapped a blanket around myself," and he took me to his stateroom, and he went up and stayed with Captain O'Brien. That was my first meeting with Captain Amundsen. Then the next time I saw him was, he came up on the Victoria again, and the Maud, his boat, followed him into Nome. And we were waiting for the ice to go out. He was coming up to try the Northwest Passage. And He went with the Ma to Siberia, where he had a friend living there, and I went on to Deering, where I was living then, and about 2 weeks after I was home, in came, the natives were shouting, "Here's a white boat, here's a white boat." And it was Captain Amson came, and he had a little Wright Brothers airplane on board. And Amdahl, who was one of his men that was flying the little ship, they brought us ashore, and about a dozen of our white men made rollers, and there was an old abandoned pipe on the beach. They filled it with sand and rolled out an airplane field. Then he took these men up for rides, and the weirdest stories that they told afterwards. They were only up about 10 minutes, but you think they've been up all day and all night. And the experiences they had and what they had seen, it was really fabulous, the extent of their going out in the airplane. That was the first plane we had up there. And later, Noel Ween came over and picked me up. I had a busted eardrum. And Norween came over from here with his cabin plane that he had bought from Captain Wilkins, the explorer. And we all had donated towards buying that plane. My husband gave $2,000. My brother-in-law gave $2,000. My brother was there that time. Of course, it was all paid back. But Noel came over and charged me $1,000, and I was supposed to have a charter trip. When we got to Ruby, we picked up a passenger there for which he got $500, but he didn't give me any rebate. But so that's the way Norwegian really started in, having planes and doing things. I financed him later on and bought a plane in Seattle, Stinson, and gave it to him, and he used it. Well, he had a pilot, one that used to come fly for the Pan American, a chap by the name of Knox, and he used our plane for about a year and then turned it back to us. So that was one of the ways that Noel Ween got started. I won't say it was entirely up to that, but it was one of the starting points for him anyways. Well, I went to the States, and my husband had been ailing all of it at that time. He was, for years, suffering with, he had frozen his foot, and he was 6 months in the New York hospital in New York. Then we went to Miami, and he died there. And all this time, I was, every once in a while, we'd see Rule Amundsen in New York, and we kept in touch. We sent Christmas cards and greetings to each other, and I finally went over there, and he had asked me to marry him. When I got into Oslo, he had gone to pick up Nobile. He thought he'd be gone for a day or so, and he was gone, never came back. So I stayed in his home there, and his nephew and niece were with me. They handed over the keys to me when I arrived there. They were very nice. I went and stayed for 2 weeks at a summer resort, and I had a nice time, and they wanted me to stay there. Well, I couldn't speak any Norwegian, just a few little words, you know, just say thank you and please and things like that, but I didn't see why I should stay on there when there wasn't any sign of him ever returning. So I brought back all of his silverware, all of his personal silverware, all of his linens, and And just recently, before I left Juneau, there was a Norwegian there going back to Oslo, and I had a beautiful pair of candelabras and old pitcher and several big pieces of silver that he said he'd take back there and put in the museum, so I gave them to him. And I imagine they're back in Norway now. I also went to Russia while I was there, and it was very interesting. I went to Sweden and boarded an icebreaker there, and we went on to Finland, where I got on a train, and at the Russian border, which we changed trains, and here was this nice little smart-looking Finnish soldier in a blue uniform and astrakhan cap, and oh, he was just as smart as any of our American soldiers. Then was boarded by a Russian with a long brown overcoat, and I was the only passenger on that train. We got in just the side of Leningrad when they stopped the train, and aboard came, it was a boxcar, an ordinary boxcar. In came a group of women, and they had been clearing the track ahead for us. And they were in the cold, and here I was in this beautiful passenger train all by myself, until we got to Leningrad. And there I met my sister-in-law and went to her home. Her husband was a doctor, very well-known doctor. He was in the with the Tsar's regime there, and they were going to kill him, but when the revolution broke out. But they spared his life because there were so many people that had known him to be a very good, kind man. And I went from there to Moscow. I stayed there for about a week. I stayed at the Grand Hotel there. I had a suite of rooms. My living room had a baby grand white piano in it and beautiful pictures on the wall. The bathroom has a tin tub and a piece of Lifebuoy soap. It reminded me of home. And my sister-in-law had a bedroom and I had one, and the food was just out of this world. They had everything that you could think of there, which we got for almost a song, because the ruble then was worth about 2 cents. Well, I went back to Norway and then came on to France and then came home. So that was my experience. But I visited the fortress of Peter and Paul, saw where they kept their prisoners, and then this beautiful cathedral where the Tsar used to worship. Oh, it was just beautiful. And this poor, there were mostly political prisoners. And they slept on just a little straw, and the windows were high up, and the walls were cement, and the floor was cement. We had to pay to go in and see these places. Anywhere you went in Russia, they charge you for it. And then we went to the Hermitage. Oh, the pictures were beautiful. They had all of the old famous painters there, and just as I was going in, I never thought, a woman walked up to me and she says, "You'll have to take off your shoes before you enter here." And there were boys and girls in there with teachers explaining who the artists were, and the furniture was just fabulous. They had all strung in, you know, with wires and things to keep you away from it, to, you know, you couldn't get too close to it. But we would get into a Vorska and we'd ride around. One day we were coming around a corner and we had this little pony, you know, and the man sitting in front. And my sister-in-law took a header out of the snow there, you know, then. Oh, she laughed, got up. She was a very charming woman, and she learned to speak English when she heard that I was coming to visit her. And she told me that she understood me perfectly because she had had an English woman teach her. And I talked, King's English because I was brought up in Canada and didn't come to the United States until I was about 15 years old. Well, I went on to France, and then I took a boat from Trieste. I came back on an Italian luxury ship. It was just beautiful. And down the Mediterranean until I came into New York. Well, my husband had left me his interest in the business, and he and his brother ran the stores up north, and I came back to Alaska. So now I'm here, and I'm at the Pioneer's home, and find it very comfortable. And when you folks get old, that's where you should come to. The personnel are divine there. They're most charming. We have good food, and our rooms are comfortable. And I don't know where I could ever have a better home. And all these charming people around. Everybody is just as sociable and kind and do so much for me. And here I am.
Well, now, Mrs. Chamberlain, what was Amundsen using this plane for that he brought up?
Well, he was just taking pictures with it and just for maneuvering to look the country over. The Wright brothers had given it to him. And Umdahl was his flyer, you know. He was later lost trying to cross the Atlantic, Umdahl. He was with Mrs. Carpenter. And it was a Sikorsky plane that they were flying over to. They were lost, I think, just outside of Newfoundland, weren't they? Mm-hmm. I believe so.
Do you remember what year that was?
1927, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, this Nobile, that was when he had this dirigible, the Italia, wasn't it, that was lost?
Yes, well, that was Amundsen's, too.
Oh, I see.
And they came over across the pole and made a forced landing at Teller.
Mm-hmm. Then they... Norga.
Norga. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I had a lot of fragments from the dirigible.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was never any trace found of Amundsen.
No, they never found. But Nobile showed up the same day that Amundsen started out to look for him. He should have never gone.
Mm. Well, now, didn't you serve in our state legislature? Not our state legislature, but our territorial legislature.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, do you care to give us a little rundown on that, please?
Well, yes. Dear old Senator Greening, he's kind of disappointing me now, but he was then governor, and I served two sessions there, and we got along beautifully, and I think we had about $700,000, and we thought we were spending lots of money, you know, just thought we were setting the world afire with that money. But strange to relate, now they spend several million dollars and we're not getting any more results than we did when we had that $700,000 to spend.
From where were you elected?
Then it was from Nome to Point Barrow and the islands, and that's where I was elected from.
Now that's judicial district, or was judicial district two.
Number two. Mm-hmm. Now they've split it all up, and there's a dozen or more districts.
How many people were there in your area that you were representing at that time?
From Point Barrow to Nome, or Nome to Point Barrow was, I would say, 4,000 people.
Did you ever make any attempt to visit these places?
Oh, yes, I visited them both in the summertime and in the wintertime. Yes, I went by dog team and by boat.
Well, in those days, what was your salary, your recompense for attending this legislature?
$15 a day and our transportation both ways.
Well, that lacked considerable of what the legislature is.
Oh, getting now?
Yeah.
I should say so.
You should get your election on tape, the little story you tell about when you was elected.
Oh, yes. You know, there was a man running against me, and it was a tie vote. And I had Grand Jackson and Nome draw a card for me, and I won by one vote. And just about the time that they had drawn the card, this man's wife came in, and she said, "Did you win?" He says, "No, I lost by one vote." She says, "You know, I forgot to vote." He was a Republican, a very nice person. He sent me a lovely telegram congratulating me. Yes.
Well, what years were you in the legislature?
In 1945 and 46.
Do you care to give us some of the highlights of that time?
Oh, of that time? Yes, I was a very good friend of Governor Greening's, and Mrs. Greening and I got along beautifully. I'd go to the governor's mansion and stay there a week at a time with them. And she's a charming woman. She's a real aristocrat. And she had brought her own cook from back east with her. Margaret was her name. It was good enough for all the governors that we've had up to the present governor, and he brought his own chef. Of course, they tell me I haven't been in the governor's mansion since Hickel has taken over, but they say it's real plush now. He's got all kinds of beautiful things in there, and I like Hickel. I think he's a good man. I am a good true Democrat, but I think Hickel is being a very good governor.
Well, were there any other women in the legislature at that time than yourself?
Well, yes, I was the only one from the 2nd Division. Then,
Alaska Link?
Yeah, Alaska Link was there with me. And, we fought bitterly. I wanted equal rights for the Eskimo and Indian, and she opposed it. But we got it. And it took about 2 weeks for us to get it. Then the welfare was just started then. I introduced the welfare bill, which shows in our what do you call those books that they have with all the minutes in it and so forth?
The records, I suppose.
Yes, records of things. Well, I introduced that welfare bill. Dr. Haglund, Dr. Scheibel, and several doctors came down from here. They weren't at all in favor of it, but I guess they don't mind now. Dr. Hagelin's been down there, and he's made a good legislator, too. I don't mean me and him, but I, that was two of the main things that we were working on at that time, was the welfare and the Equal Rights Bill. Sometimes I'm sorry now that I advocated it, but I thought that people were being oppressed in our part of the country because they weren't allowed to sit in the lower part of the movie theaters and couldn't go to hotels, you know, were forbidden, and now they all have the same privileges. And I think they're doing much better. I'll be glad when they really get rid of the BIA and have just our state and federal government take care of our schools and hospitals and things. That's my natural reaction. I don't know. Maybe I'm prejudiced, but I feel that the people are, everybody should be equal, regardless of color or creed. And we've had some very fine legislators from up north, and from southeastern and southwestern Alaska.
Well, were you an ardent advocate of statehood?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. Of course, I was being influenced a great deal by Governor Greening and by different people, you know, from southeastern. That I think, though, now that we should still have the territorial system back. It was just, you know, like everything, we're just sheep that follow the one that had the bell around its neck. But
One question I think that we've overlooked so far this evening is, where were you born?
Oh, I was born in Winnipeg, Manitoba. My father came there I have it down here. My father came to Winnipeg when it was in 1831. He was in the horse and cattle business.
And his name was?
Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R.
Mm-hmm. And his first name would be?
Isaac.
Isaac Berger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was Scandinavian, I presume?
No, he was from Alsace-Lorraine.
Oh.
No. And he was in the horse and cattle business. And we had yours and mine and our family. He had been married before, and he married my mother, and they had a family. And my mother had two children. So we had about 18 at our table. And my mother was French-Canadian. And my father would go on trips and pick up horses and cattle, drive them to Winnipeg and sell them. When he died, he was 72 years old, and they brought him in from the country where he was driving a team of horses, and they were high-spirited, and they hit a stump and he fell out and he broke his neck. He lived for 3 weeks with a broken neck. And when he died, why, we found in his desk thousands of dollars in notes that had been given by the farmers around there for horses and cattle. But we fared all right. We had, my brothers were there, and they took care of the younger ones. They all ranged from the age of 2 years was the youngest, and my oldest brothers were in their 50s. I come from a long life family.
And you left from, you left Winnipeg and...
To Seattle. To live with my brother and sister.
Oh, I understand. You had moved there prior, obviously prior to this.
Yes.
Now, I don't know if we have the name of your first husband, who was a trader at Kotzebue when you lived there.
His name was Sam Magids, M-A-G-I-D-S.
Can you spell it again, please?
M-A-G-I-D-S. Sam.
And another question, well, you were a legislator. Your husband had died by that time. Was your name Chamberlain at that particular time?
No, my name was Cross then.
Well, you were Mrs. Cross at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
And you subsequently were married to?
I was married first to Mr. Magids, and he died. Then I married Chamberlain, and we... couldn't see eye to eye. He wanted to live in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
He had gone there with Governor Troy, and Bob Bartlett was with him at the time, with the governor, and Bob Bartlett decided to stay in Washington, and then he consequently became our representative in Washington. And my husband came back up north with me, Art Chamberlain. He was a newspaper man. And he wanted to go back to Washington, and I couldn't see that. I wanted to stay up north. So he left, and a couple of years later, I married John Cross. And he's still alive, but he's living in Kotzebue.
I see.
But, that, and I have a daughter here.
Oh, I understand.
Yes, Pat Chamberlain.
You might list your... You have one daughter living in Alaska?
Yes, she lives right here in, Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm. And her name is?
Pat Clark now.
Pat Clark.
Yes, she was on the staff of Jessen's Weekly.
Oh, I understand.
And previous to that, she was a lecturer at the University of Alaska for 2 years.
Did you have any other children?
No.
One child?
Uh-huh. She got her BA and her master's degree out here at the university. All after she married... Bill Clark. She went to school for 15 years in order to graduate.
Well, she had persistence.
Yes, indeed was. It was very commendable, too, because they had a struggle. I helped them all I could, but they had to make their own way. But she has 4 daughters. And she kept on working just the same at the university and going to school. And her daughters are 5 years old to 15.
Oh, I see. I have nothing further. Possibly some of the audience would like to ask Mrs. Chamberlain some questions.
Now, will you start?
Yes.
Wait a minute.
As Bishop Rowe was visiting us in Kotzebue, those days he'd fly, and he'd go to Deering first, and if we weren't there, he'd come to Kotzebue. And he'd always tell a little anecdote that he experienced on the trail, and he told about going to the head of the Yukon, and he was thinking about this man's wife, and the man was thinking about his boat. And Bishop Rowe says, "Well, how is your wife?" And this man thought, well, he was interested in this boat. And so he says, "Oh, well," he says, "she's an awful mess. Her ribs are all stove in, and her bottom is rotten." And this man looked at him, Bishop Rowe looked at him and said, "Oh, who are you talking about?" He says, "My boat." Well, Mr. Rowe says, "I want to know how your wife is." "Oh," he says, "she's all right. She's the same all the time." Then he told one on Archdeacon Stuck, he said that Archdeacon Stuck was going up the Yukon, and they got stuck on a bar. And another boat came along, and this man called to him and said, "What's your name?" And Archdeacon Stuck says, "I'm Stuck." Oh, he says, "Anybody can see you're stuck, but what's your name?" Oh, he had a real sense of humor. I loved old Bishop Rowe. He's marvelous. So was Archdeacon Stuck. They were both charming people. They lived at Tanana, you know, and they had a mission there. And I used to come through there, and we'd stop there and visit with them. Always stayed 2 or 3 days. I made 4 trips out over the trail. The first time it was from Kotzebue to Cordova. The next time it was from Deering to Valdez. And the third time it was to Nenana, where we took the train and came to Anchorage and Seward and took the boat out from there. The fourth time the same way. But it was interesting. The shortest time we were 19 and a half days by dog team. Then we'd be 6 or 7 days on the boat to get to Seattle. And then from Seattle, why, we'd go east, and it always take us about 6 weeks or 2 months to get to New York or wherever we were going. And we stay there about 2 months, and then we come back come back up north. But it was interesting. We used to make a roadhouse every day. When I flew with Norwegian from Deering to Fairbanks, it used to take us 24 hours, you know, really mushing dogs and making it kind of tough on ourselves. We used to pass these places in 20 minutes on the plane.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you tell us a little bit more about Japhet Lindbergh, who was the founder, one of the founders of Nome?
Yes, he was a reindeer herder, and he came over from Lapland with these deer, which he later turned over to the Lohmann brothers. And they had a place called Baldwin, where a man by the name of Baldwin supplied them with the money to buy a boat that they called the Baldwin. And they took reindeer meat out. They had a cold storage. And Japhet had mining interests in Nome. And he and his wife, Josephine, they lived in Nome for years, going back and forth. Japhet used to relate a story about a man that worked for him. He was a good Scandinavian, and he'd worked about 6 years for Japhet Lindbergh, digging into the ground, you know, sluicing off muck and dirt, and this man decided to go to the States. So he got to Seattle, and he met Japhet Lindbergh on the street one day. And he says, "Japhet, will you give me some money?" And Japhet said, "Well, what'd you do with all the money that you had?" "Oh," he says, "you know, easy come, easy go." But Japhet was a very kind man, and very generous with his money, and a good man to work for. His Miss Hall was a pride of the country. Everything was well taken care of. You know, the Scandinavians are known for their good hospitality and their good food and helping people along. He used to let us go and pan and whatever we'd get. Sometimes we'd get as high as $40 in a pan. He'd insist upon us keeping the gold.
Mm-hmm.
He was a true Alaskan.
Well, didn't Lindbergh call with quite a lot of money?
Hey, pardon?
Didn't Lindbergh call with quite a lot of money there from Nome?
Did he try what?
Didn't he have quite a lot of money when he came out of Nome?
Oh, yes, yes.
He started the Scandinavian American Bank in Seattle.
Yes, he started the Scandinavian American Bank.
Well, wasn't Ole Larson with him at that time?
Hey, pardon?
Ole Larson?
Yes, yes. He was the head of the bank in Seattle.
But was he in Nome? Was Ole in Nome? Ole Larson in Nome?
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was there for a while. I knew him, too. Mm-hmm.
Was the bank a success?
No.
No.
It failed.
No. No, Japhet dropped a lot of money in it.
Mm.
You spoke of Baldwin. Was this missionary Baldwin? The Methodist missionary?
No, that was a different Baldwin. No, this man was from New York, and he financed the Lohmann brothers with
several hundred thousand dollars. But they made no success out of their reindeer venture at all. There were, well, there's Carl Owen, who was very, was then, and I don't know whether he's alive now or not, but a very well-known Republican. And then there was Ralph, and Alfred Jr. is here. There was Alfred, and then there was another brother that is married, and I think his wife was in the library, no, in Juneau. That's where she was. But there's, and there was one sister. They lived in Nome for a good number of years.
If there are no further questions from the group, well, I'd like to thank you, Mrs. Chamberlain, for a very interesting story, very interestingly told, and we trust that we'll have your presence here again.
Well, thank you. I'm all. I hope I didn't bore you folks too much.
you'll be a very difficult person to follow.